to begin by paying respects to the Burramadigal people of the Darug Nation upon whose land we sit and who occupied and looked after this land for thousands of years and have never ceded it to the current authorities. And so I pay respects to their elders, past, present and future. And I hope that we can honour their legacy of caring for our land and looking out for it as well as they did for such a long time. For today, we will be introducing a course, and over the next few days we will be explaining different aspects of dependent origination. This particular course was put together originally by Venerable Brahmali and taught by him in Perth at the BSWA, and then we'll change it and adapt it a bit, I guess, as we go. But the basic bones of it are similar to what was taught there. And our aim is to present a, I guess, reasonably comprehensive teaching on dependent origination, because it is one of those things that, because it has a degree of complexity and depth that often can't be addressed by the bounds of a simple Dhamma talk. So we wanted to be able to spend a little bit of time to go a bit further into the teachings than sometimes we might ordinarily be able to do. Now, because of the depth and the richness and the complexity of dependent origination, it attracts a wide variety of commentary and a lot of theories and a lot of ideas about it. And as you all probably know, our perspective is to base ourselves on the teachings of the Buddha found in the suttas, what we call the early Buddhist texts. And so that's the perspective that we're going to be bringing to you over these next few days.
As you said, the this teaching is very, you really consider very profound, yeah, difficult to understand. But the point is that you don't want to scare people by saying straight away it's profound, because then people get scared and they walk out and next session is only one or two people left, and that would be no good. So you want to see people to stay for a while, otherwise we have a problem. And one of the things about any teaching of the Buddha is that it comes in many different levels. One, some of the levels are very profound because it actually does concern some of the deepest aspects of Buddhism, such as non-self, such as the Buddha's a critique of the existing religions in India at the time, which had to do with the idea of non-self. But at the same time, there's also many ways in which dependent origination is easy to understand. Yeah, some of the ideas are not very profound or difficult. And in fact, if you use dependent origination in the right way, it is also can also be very practical. Yeah, there are very practical aspects of these teachings, which everyone can kind of put into action and help you to go move forward on the Buddhist path. So one of the so that is going to be part of this. I don't really know what's going to happen, but we'll see what happens. Hopefully, that's going to be part of it and make it a bit practical, a bit deep, a bit everything, really. But to start out, one of the things that we want to do is we want to ensure that dependent origination, as Bhantisuddhanta said, according to early Buddhist teachings. Yeah, and so what we need to do, we need to understand how to interpret the text according to the early Buddhist teachings. And this is really important because dependent origination has been interpreted in so many different ways. And some of those, to be quite frank, are not in accordance with the early Buddhist teachings. So we're going to give you a framework for how to interpret these texts, how to actually use the text to interpret them in the right way, and how to use a historical approach to understand them in the right way, and all of this. So the idea is that hopefully by the end of even today, you will have some idea on what is the appropriate approach to this particular text, so that you can actually get more out of them and understand how they work, so you have a bit more ability to read them in a way that is the way the Buddha wanted us to understand these texts. Before we get into dependent origination, however, I want to talk a little bit about early Buddhism and the early Buddhist texts, just to give you that background once again. And so we're going to start with that, and then that will set the scene for incorporate dependent origination into the idea of the early Buddhist texts. So let's hit this little thing and see what happens. Early Buddhist texts.
So, early Buddhist texts. What can I say? What are they again? Yeah. Like suttas and things?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so You see, we have this thing, I'm sure you've heard of this thing that we call Buddhism, right? Yes?
Yeah.
We heard of Buddhism. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page, okay? And, okay, we have this thing called Buddhism. And Buddhism is the thing that you sign in the census form when it comes around every few years and it says, what are you? And you say, I'm a Buddhist. Is that right?
The number's up.
The number's up, yeah. So, okay, but what is it? What's it about? Well, obviously, what we call Buddhism is very complex, and there's Buddhists across all many different countries, and they are very, you know, do different things and practice different ways. And Buddhism has also been around for a long time. But like any of these things, it has a source. And it's something which is a feature, I guess, of the way that we understand things or the way that we know things, is that we understand things best when we go back to the source. And we understand why things are the way they are. And if we want to understand Buddhism, then it seems to me the best way of understanding Buddhism is to go back to the source of where all of these things came from. And the source of all of these things, of course, is... Who can tell me?
Buddha.
The Buddha, yes. Thank you. You're firing on all cylinders today. Okay, so the Buddha, right. And the Buddha was a man who lived in India 2,500 years ago. And like so many, wanted to leave the world to try to discover the key to letting go of suffering. Many have done that before, many have done it since. Few have found their way to the answer. And the Buddha, we believe, was one of those who did. And of course, the name of the Buddha and the achievement of the Buddha is something which has resonated through history until the present day as the name of somebody whose wisdom is transparent and transcendent and transformative. So for 45 years, the Buddha taught. He had a community. That community memorized his teachings. And they organized them into a formal set of doctrines, a formal set of texts that we know today as the early Buddhist texts. And we are mostly familiar these days with the texts found in Pali, but those early texts are found preserved not just in Pali, but also in Sanskrit. Oh, I got that down there, okay. I should know something about this, gold standard, blah, 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 source of Buddhism. I'll say that also. I'll come to that in a minute. Also preserved in other languages. My point here being that when we're talking about the early Buddhist texts, we're not just talking about the things which underlie the Theravada school of Buddhism or this particular Nikaya or that particular group. Thank you so much for that reminder of uncertainty. The Buddha taught us that all things are impermanent and suffering. And we've now got that reminder. But we don't need a second reminder. So we appreciate the first reminder very gratefully. And perhaps if people might switch off their phones for the second reminder, then that would also be very gratefully appreciated. What?
There's a phone in here.
There's nothing to do with me. Well, no,
it's not. Should it be turned off or should it be turned on?
Don't worry, nobody ever calls me. I don't have any friends.
Okay.
So, welcome, Marianne. Okay, so where were we? Oh, yes, Buddhist teachings, mobile phones. It's sobering to think that from this day forward, there will never be a gathering of people that will not be interrupted by some device. It's sobering to think, yeah? Anyway, right, so the community organized these scriptures, memorized them originally as an oral tradition, passed them down to the present day. Oral tradition originally then as a manuscript tradition and currently as a digital tradition. And so this is one of the main areas, of course, that I work in with Sutta Central is to preserve and make available these scriptures. So the important thing about all of this is that this is where everything in Buddhism comes from. And we have, Buddhism is a very rich tradition, and it's a very diverse tradition. And of all the people in this room, everybody is at a different place in their spiritual growth. Everybody is practicing in a different way. Everybody has a different understanding. And that's natural. It's natural that everybody has a different understanding. But what we want to try to do as Dhamma practitioners, and what we want to try to do as teachers of Dhamma, is to try to make sure that our understanding is informed, that we have a critical and intelligent and reflective understanding of what the Dhamma is. And our growth in Dhamma can be guided by knowledge rather than by ignorance. So we can't, in a course like this, we're not going to, unfortunately, strip away your ignorance and get you enlightened. I mean, we might do, we hope, I don't know, but usually it doesn't happen quite that easily, right? Because you have to do your meditation and that kind of thing, right? So we can't, by teaching about ignorance, we can't make your ignorance go away. But we can give you some support and some framework that can help you to practice in a better way that's going to help you to overcome that ignorance. So this is what we're trying to do here. Gold standard. What did you mean by gold standard, Ben? Well, you said gold standard here. Tell us, what's the gold standard?
Okay, gold standard, silver standard, something like that. But the idea is that very often when we come across Buddhist teachings, whether that is the contemporary teachings or it is the commentaries, or it is all the teachings that have come down in Buddhist history, sometimes it's very hard to know what to make of them, how to understand them, how to interpret them. And to be able to do that, you have to have some kind of standard by which to judge any teaching. When you hear a new teacher, you hear Ajahn Brahm, or you hear Rinpoche so-and-so, and Aya so-and-so, and Bhante so-and-so, and whatever it is, you always have to have something by which to judge the teachings, whether they are acceptable or not. And sometimes in our world, people just accept the teachings of a teacher, just take it on board without really reflecting on it. And that's always can be dangerous, because it means sometimes you get the wrong end of the stick. You don't get Buddhism, you get something else. You don't know what it's called. What's it called? It's not Buddha, is it called some, any name for that? Anyway, it's called, it's somehow based on Buddhism, but it isn't really the real teaching. So it's very handy to have something you can go back to, which is very likely to be the teachings of the historical Buddha. And one of the great things that I learned from Bhaddhasudrata is this idea of textual analysis, whereby you analyze the text and you ensure that, to the best of your ability to find out whether these texts actually go back to the Buddha or not, and what are the earliest version of these texts. And they are very good grounds, I would say, and many people say that, for taking the core doctrines, the core teachings of the early suttas as the teachings of the historical Buddha. And the point here, of course, is that everything in Buddhism, the whole commentarial tradition, the Mahayana tradition, all the various schools of Buddhism that have arisen over the centuries and millennia, and we're talking about large number of schools, the Zen schools in various Zen schools in Japan, the various schools in China, the various schools in Southeast Asia, and across the Buddhist world, Tibet, whatever it is, all arose because of the historical Buddha. And all of these schools only have meaning insofar as they relate back to the early teachings. That's what the meaning comes from. So if you take away the early teachings, everything else really collapses. And so to understand all the later teachings, the only way to understand them is to refer back to the early Buddhist texts. So this is kind of really, once you get this idea, it actually becomes incredibly significant and incredibly important. So when you hear someone teach, like you hear us teach today, you should always ask yourself, are we teaching according to the early Buddhist text? Are we teaching according to this gold standard? Or are we teaching according to some other dodgy standard, which no one really should be listening to?
What if we have like a platinum standard?
What is best, the platinum and gold? What is better? I don't know. We the highest standard anyway, whatever is the highest standard. That is the idea so this is one of the reasons why it's very important actually to be able to question one of the things about the early Buddhist teachings, you read the word of the Buddha, there was quite a lot of questioning. Yeah, they would go to the Buddha and say, Venerable Sir, what is the meaning of this? And one of the very famous suttas is where the Buddha asks Venerable Sariputta. Yeah, Venerable Sariputta is the right-hand monk of the Buddha. And the Buddha asks him, well, do you have faith in this? And Venerable Sariputta says, no. That's interesting, right? And the Buddha said, well, how come you have, what do you mean you haven't got faith? And of course, he replies, well, the reason I haven't got faith is because I know this for myself. Yeah. So the idea in Buddhism is always to try to approach these things from an internal perspective, actually understanding these things for oneself, and then giving a rise to one's own inner knowledge. So it should always be an inquiring path, a path for kind of understanding here. So please feel free to ask questions throughout. Yeah, I think this is a very important part. Do we have any system for questions, or is it just any? No, okay, so no system. So that means you can ask questions any time. That's probably what it means. Yeah.
We'll probably have more time for questions later on and stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, not straight away, in other words. Okay. Okay, so I'm not sure what the next one is, but I'll pass it back to you. Yeah, that's a good one for you.
Is it? What does it mean?
Atta-kata. Atta.
Well, you tell, I don't know what it means.
The given meaning is that that's basically the same as the previous one. The idea is that all later Buddhism gets its meaning through the early suttas. Right. Yeah, so whatever there is of Buddhism in the world, its meaning only exists insofar as it somehow is related to the early suttas. So they give the meaning to everything here. So then this is your business.
All right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay. So So our primary source for the early Buddhist text is the four Nikayas in Pali, or otherwise known as the Agamas. Which are in Chinese translation. Also, there's various other texts in Sanskrit and Tibetan and various other things and so on. But the main source is these Nikayas or Agamas. And we're not going to be doing a detailed comparative study of all of these as we go along, but we will we'll give a bit of a comparison on a few salient details. One of the things about studying the Pali Nikayas and the Agamas and other sources of Buddhist teachings is that when it comes to the main doctrines, the main teachings, they are always effectively identical. So we occasionally find small differences in things like the arrangement of things or the wording of things and so on. It might be a little bit different from one text to the other, but the basic teachings are always word for word identical, and we're going to show you a bit that later. We're going to show you that a bit later on in the context of dependent origination. So this is why we're not going to be necessarily referring across all of these things all of the time. So for both Brahmali and myself, our main focus of study has been with the Pali texts, and that's what we're going to be focusing on, and that's normally the case for most people. When we look at the Pali texts, we have the oldest and most consistent and well understood set of texts for the early Buddhist teachings. And because the Pali texts are very linguistically clear and they are well commented on, we have a whole commentarial apparatus, we have so much study and so on that's been done on them. So the Agamas are also extremely valuable, but because they're in Chinese, then we're reading them through a translation, so they're never quite as clear as the Pali text. So the Pali text will always be the foundational scriptures for early study of early Buddhism, but the Agamas and other texts also enrich that understanding and can help to inform certain areas that might be unclear. So all of these texts, all of the Nikayas and the Agamas are, of course, on Sutta Central, and we have all of the Nikayas in translation, in English translation and other languages, and we have some of the Agamas as well from Chinese translation, and we actually are sponsoring a scholar in the United States to translate from Chinese to English for the Agamas, Charles Patton. And he's doing a really amazing job to be able to do that. So this is one of the first times we've had a kind of systematic attempt to translate from the Chinese Agamas into English. So some of these are available on Sutta Central already, and this is giving us an opportunity to see the Buddhist scriptures as they were received through the different Buddhist traditions. Okay. Dogen history. you want to do this one? Or do you want me to?
You can do this one. This is
good. All right. Okay, so. Whose is that? It's deep.
How come it's
deep.
Not to be found. Here it is.
Here it is. Beautiful. Oops. Sorry about that. Just make sure that doesn't happen. Make sure that doesn't happen again. All right. It is good as clock, yeah. Right, so because dependent origination is such an important teaching throughout the whole Buddhist tradition, then it is one of those things which is constantly being revitalized, being reinterpreted, being transmitted, and being framed and presented in all kinds of different ways. And we have a rich history of the way that that happens. So dependent origination, as it's taught in the suttas, in the EBTs, or early Buddhist texts, we have a straightforward formula of the 12 factors of dependent origination in origination and cessation, and we have a lot of different variations upon that. We have analysis, we have the definitions of terms, we have the presentation of that teaching in lots of different contexts. But that teaching, as we as found in the suttas, tends to be like a particular teaching in a particular time in a particular place. So you have many different teachings, each showing a different aspect of it. But what you don't find is like an overall treatise or a sort of systematic explanation that's going to explain everything about dependent origination. So later generations then take up those teachings, take up all the hundreds of teachings on dependent origination, and they try to bring them together and to analyze them and to give a systematic overall teaching of dependent origination. Now that, of course, on the one hand is very useful because it brings together information in a more handy form. On the other hand, you also lose something because it's not just an abstract teaching. It's a context where one human being is talking to another human being about their suffering and about the things that they need to hear in that time and that place. And so when we abstract everything out from the context and we treat it purely as a doctrine, then we lose something of the humanity that we find in the teachings in the suttas and in the early Buddhist texts. So this is one of the reasons why I love the suttas so much, because they are about one human being talking to another or talking to a group about the things that are of most deep concern to all of them. So this process of abstracting, summarizing, organizing dependent origination began with the Abhidhamma Pitaka in Theravada. So we have various presentations of the dependent origination there, through other treatises and commentaries, and finally sort of reached its apotheosis in the Visuddhimagga, the great Theravadan meditation manual of the 4th century. And in the wisdom section of the Visuddhimagga, there's an extensive analysis of dependent origination that goes into a lot of different details and is actually really interesting and gives a lot of really interesting perspectives. So I don't think we're going to be looking at that in detail, but certainly worthwhile if you're interested to go into it further. Of course, in Theravada wasn't the only tradition to do this, and we find teachings and interpretations of dependent origination through other schools of Buddhism as well. And I'm not so familiar with all of those, but I just remember reading a book by His Holiness the Dalai Lama a number of years ago, and he talked about dependent origination. And he gave this analysis of dependent origination and went through all of the factors. And honestly, everything that he talked about was exactly identical with, you know, you could have said that this was from Ajahn Brahm or something like that, and his explanation was exactly the same as somebody from Theravada might explain it. So clearly the basic understanding of dependent origination has been preserved down through those traditions. What was really interesting to me when listening to the Dalai Lama talk about it was that even some of the interpretive problems that we have in the Pali tradition, then they had the same interpretive problems in the Tibetan tradition. So one of the ones I'm thinking about is people sometimes have a problem explaining what's the difference between upadana and tanha, right? You have craving, conditions, grasping, but they're actually both very similar in meaning. So what's the distinction there between craving and grasping, between tanha and upadana? And so that's a kind of interpretive problem that a number of different commentators have explained in different ways in Theravada. And you found that the Dalai Lama was the same thing. Like he was saying, well, this is an interpretive problem and this is one way of explaining it. So this is showing how close these versions are in these different traditions. So again, our aim here is not to look at the way that all of these traditions have explained it, but simply to acknowledge the fact that these explanations are there. That they all reflect an attempt by Buddhists in different times and places to understand and to explain dependent origination in terms that mattered to them. And some of those explanations are very philosophically acute and have informed Buddhist philosophy till the present day. And I'm thinking particularly of Nagarjuna and his Mula Madhyamaka Karika, who interpreted dependent origination in a way that was very sneaky and hence I like it. But anyway, so down into modern times, again, we continue the process of interpreting dependent origination in ways that are suitable for our time and our place. And we have to do this, right? We can't not do it. The way that we talk about it is shaped by our language, it's shaped by our context, it's shaped by the technology that we use, it's shaped by the places that we can sit in, it's shaped by all of our context, and that, of course, is all dependently originated. I'm going to try not to give too many dependent origination puns, but sometimes you can't avoid it. So it's conditioned. Our teaching and our understanding of dependent origination is always conditioned. And one of the things that tends to happen when you have a very ancient tradition of Buddhism, an ancient tradition like that of Buddhism, is that everybody builds on what everybody has done before. And you keep on building and building and building on what you've heard. And of course, that's where you get sort of many layers and you get away from where you started from. And so you also find the opposite tendency, as well as building on what came before, there's always the tendency to go back to the source. And so there's the kind of two dynamic tendencies. It's not that one is right or one is wrong, but that they together, that's what creates a tradition. Like on the one hand, we build on what's come before, but on the other hand, we need to reform it and revitalize it by going back to the source. Dependent origination in modern times has been a vital source of interpretation and discussion in many forms of modern Buddhism. Continue.
Okay. I want to ask you some questions. That is true. So you reinterpret and you kind of build up dependent origination each culture at the time, just to understand it in your context. But there is certainly must be a danger there as well. Surely, I mean, when you reinterpret it or you understand it in terms of your own culture, sometimes things can get lost, right? Is that a problem in Buddhist history? Like take the Visuddhimagga, for example, or take whatever in Buddhist history. Has there been that sort of, can you see that problem recurring in Buddhist history?
Yeah. Well, I feel like this is a leading question here, Venerable. Well, we were going to go on and discuss the myths of independent origination, so that may be a chance to discuss some of those places.
Yeah. But just want to say something general about it?
Do I want to say something general about it? Not particularly?
No, you don't want to? Okay.
Because I feel like you've already said something general about it.
Okay.
Do you want me to say something else general about it?
Entirely up to you. I'll give this question
to decide. No, I think we're good. I think we'll cover it when it comes to the myths, yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Okay. Give me the phone.
All right, give it back. All right, yeah, okay, there you go.
Okay. We know each other really well because we had kind of known each other for 25 years, something like that. So it's a long time. We should be. It's amazing. We're not enemies already. How's that possible? Can it be explained? Or is it nothing to do with dependent origination?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, yeah. We practice
metta or something. I don't know. It's more to do with distance. But that's right. Were you Sujato before?
Yeah.
You were Sujato before.
Yeah, not Sumino. Not Sumino. There's another one who was Sumino.
Who was Sumino?
That was the tall German. Remember him?
Nandio.
Andreas Nandio. Yeah.
Yeah. Nandio. Yeah. When he was originally ordained, he was Sujato.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I heard there's another Sujato already, so then someone said, you had to change your name, so then I became Brahmali from then on.
So that would have been very confusing.
Yeah. So anyways, I just wanted to add very briefly that one of the interesting things about this history of textual history or dependent origination is that, generally speaking, you find that dependent origination has been understood in a certain way throughout Buddhist history with a small variations. But in modern times, because of the influence of, you know, of religions like, I suppose, Christianity and Western philosophy and all these kind of things, in modern times, they have sometimes taken on a very different character. And this is one of the things that we were discussing later on. And that's where you have to be careful. Yeah, you have to be really careful with not losing, chucking out the proverbial baby with the bathwater, because if you do that, then you lose the essence of these teachings. So what we want to do now is the following. Just to have a quick outline of dependent origination. Is that my job or your job? It's my job. Okay, yeah. Just to have an outline so that... Is anyone new to dependent origination here? Is anyone completely... You're new. Okay, good.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Yeah.
So good.
That's great.
So good. That's excellent.
Yeah. So just for you, we're going to give an outline so you have some idea what's going on, yeah? So this is kind of the idea behind this. So dependent origination is a series of 12 factors, and each one is linked to the one coming after it by, you can call it causality. Maybe causality is not quite the ideal word, but basically one factor leading on to the next one, yeah? And it's once you have one, the next one will follow as a matter of course. So we'll have a quick explanation of these 12 factors and how each one leads to the next one. So this is just the outline. And if you don't get it, don't worry too much. We're going to talk about this in much more detail later on. So dependent origination starts. The very first point is ignorance, known as avidya in Pali. And avidya does not mean just ignorance in the ordinary way we think about it in English. Ignorance in English usually means a lack of knowledge. Yeah, you go to university to avoid being ignorant. But this has more to do with a misunderstanding of the reality of the world. Yeah, so delusion would be one way of putting it. It's a kind of a mixture of ignorance and delusion, if you like. And because you misunderstand the nature of reality, that has a certain effect on how you live your life, obviously. Yeah, if you don't know kind of up from down and left from right, if you get things the wrong way around, it's going to be detrimental even in ordinary life, let alone in the spiritual life. So because of that ignorance, and in particular, there's a few main things of ignorance that are really problematic. One of them is that we think that we know where happiness is to be found. Yeah, we think we know where satisfaction is to be found in the world. And because we think that, we pursue those things in the world that we think are going to lead to our happiness and satisfaction. According to Buddhism, we don't understand where we find happiness. Yeah? If we did, everyone would be supremely happy already. But if you look around the world, you see that is actually not the case. So this is the first aspect of delusion. The second aspect of delusion is that we think that we have the power to create that happiness in our life. And this is called the delusion of a sense of self, where we feel that we have the creative ability to make this life satisfactory and happy for ourselves. So based on that delusion, what happens then? Well, we start acting to pursue that happiness, yeah, using that sense of self, the agent inside. And that is then the second factor called choices by Bhante Sujato. There's many different translations. This term behind this is called sankhara in Pali. And I wasn't sure which term to use, which translation to use. And I remembered I'm going to do this with Bhante Sujato, and I don't dare to use any other term except for his translation. Yeah? I'll get into his bad books if I didn't use his translation. So this is one of those things. Sometimes you have to be...
Also right.
Yes, that is, of course, utterly... Yeah, that's objective, right? Utterly objective truth, of course. Yeah, of course, yeah. No, so, yeah, that's what I mean. So I would, you know, you can start to get the idea of why I wouldn't choose anything else. So this is my choice based on delusion. I choose choices. So you make choices in the world, yeah? You act, you try to create this happiness for yourself in the world. And as we create happiness, what we do, part of that, very important part of that, is we make good karma and we make bad karma, yeah? And the good karma and bad karma we make affects our consciousness, yeah? And you can know that for yourself. If you look inside of yourself, you can see how your intentions affect how you feel about yourself. This is the basic idea of karma, is the relationship between intentions on the one hand and how you feel about yourself on the other. Very simple idea of karma, yeah? What you intend, and then how you feel about yourself. So it affects our consciousness. So that's the next one. So if you make a lot of good karma, if you do the good things in life, if you do act with kindness and care or whatever, it is as if your consciousness becomes brighter. Yeah, this is how we create kind of inner happiness, joy, tranquility, peace, all these kind of things. If you do a lot of bad karma, then you're kind of suppressing your consciousness. It becomes darker, more negative, and it kind of pulls it down, if you like. And then, depending on the sum total of these actions at the end of your life, yeah, it is as if you have a certain station in the kind of one of the terms on the sutta, as a station of consciousness. And that station decides then where you get reborn. And then when you get reborn, you will have a tendency, whatever that rebirth is, to have certain experiences. Yeah, and those experiences here can be called, called name and form. Why experiences are called name and form, we will come back to this later. This is quite a complicated area, but just take it to mean your experiences in that world will depend on the station of your consciousness. If you get born in the human realm, you can expect human experiences. Yeah, if you get reborn as a monk, no, you can't do that. That's impossible. You can get reborn as an animal, yeah, as a kangaroo. Yeah, then you have kangaroo experiences. If you have, what was it, ibis is called again? Bin chicken. Yeah, if you get reborn as a bin chicken, then you have experience accordingly. So depending on where you are, your consciousness station, you experience the world accordingly. Then when you experience the world accordingly within that realm, within that world, yeah, you have what is called the sixth sense field. This is basically the six senses together with the objects or together with the experiences within those objects, and. So when you have the six senses, then you will experience, contact the world through those six senses. And when you contact the world through those six senses, you feel the world through those six senses. And so, yeah, so whenever we contact the world here, again, it's just another word for experience. And every experience in life has a certain feeling with it. It's negative, it's bad, it's neutral. Yeah, this is kind of the feelings. And based on those feelings, yeah, and this is kind of, now we come into kind of the so one of the core aspects of dependent origination, which drives this whole process. Based on the feelings in life, we crave. Yeah, if something feels good, you crave for it. If something feels bad, you want to get rid of it. So craving is the next one. When we crave for things, one of the things that we want to do, we want to ensure that our cravings are satisfied. So cravings leads to a sense of taking things up in the world, grasping onto things. And this can mean taking up here, both in the literal and also the metaphorical sense of taking up. Yeah. So we take up Buddhism. Yeah. Are you Buddhist because you think it's a good idea or because you think it's a bad idea? Because you think it's a good idea, right? Hopefully, unless you have some strange ideas about this. So we take up the Buddhist teachings, yeah? We take up the monastic life. You take up a certain job. You take up having children, whatever it might be. This is called upadana, the taking up of things, the grasping of things. Then when you grasp things, your life takes a certain direction. Yeah, you live in a certain particular way. The sum total of your various graspings, the various takings up, means that your life have a certain direction. You tend to think about certain things. You tend to be inclined to certain things. This is then called the continued existence. You exist through that way. And then when you exist in a certain way, then just as I said before, your consciousness is stationed in a certain place. That then gives rise to rebirth according to that station. Your continued existence is one way of thinking about the idea of the station of consciousness. So you are reborn accordingly. And when you are reborn, what happens then?
Ow.
Yeah. So the last factor is ow. No, is it?
Technically
it's ow, but what about untechnically? Oof. So once you are reborn, yeah, you are stuffed. That's kind of the last factor is actually stuffed. Is that right?
Yeah, stuffed. Yeah.
Yeah, stuffed. So this is stuffed. Old age, death, and suffering. Yeah. Once we have rebirth, you have to continue on with this kind of random existence. And that is dependent origination here. So, yeah. Anyway, I think I've talked way too much already. It's your turn again.
Right.
Yeah.
Go me to the next one?
Yeah.
Okay, going. All right, okay, this sounds like fun.
This is
okay. All right. All right, so here we are just going to briefly look at comparing the terminology independent origination with that in Pali and in Sanskrit. And, of course, you know what these two things are, right? You know what Pali is, yes? Yeah, you know what Pali is? Good. What's Pali? Sorry?
Language.
It's a language? It's an old language. That's a very... Well, it's an answer. That's definitely an answer, yes. That's an answer. I did. No, that's good. Thank you for that. Can anybody be more specific about Pali? Sorry? Nepali? 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 No, it's not Nepali. Unfortunately, it's the same language group, but no, it's not Nepali. Sorry to say. Okay, yeah, so it's the language that the teachings of the Buddha are preserved in the Pali Tripitaka, that's correct. So Pali is an Indic language that was current in the centuries BC, and it is what is known as a Prakrit, or a colloquial language, as opposed to Sanskrit, which is a formalized language. And Pali was the language which traditionally has been regarded as the language of the Buddha himself. There is still ongoing a scholarly debate about whether it's exactly the language the Buddha spoke or perhaps a little bit different, but regardless, it's certainly very close to the language that the Buddha spoke. And so for most of us who practice within the Theravada tradition, Pali is the language we're familiar with. We chant Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato, and that's all in Pali. We chant Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, and that's in Pali, and so on. But we also have, so I mentioned before about the early Buddhist scriptures. Now, the greatest quantity of early Buddhist scriptures is in Chinese. Okay, so the biggest number is in Chinese. And the reason that it's the biggest number is because they have multiple translations of some text, especially Vinaya texts. So there's about six different Vinayas translated into Chinese. In Pali, we just have one, right? Quantity is not quality, right? It doesn't necessarily mean it's better, but there's more of it because they translated from many different schools. There's a much smaller quantity of early Buddhist material in Sanskrit. There are no existing schools of Buddhism that natively use Sanskrit. Right, but the Sanskrit texts that we have are from chance finds in different places. Some of them were random finds that were maintained in monasteries in Nepal, as it happens, or Tibet. And sometimes these were manuscripts that were literally taken into these monasteries 1,000 years ago and copied and stuck on a library shelf, and then just left there for 1,000 years, until many of them recovered in modern times by a monk called Rahul Sankrityayana, who traveled through these areas and retrieved some of the ancient manuscripts. Others were excavated from Central Asia, from the caves in Dunhuang, from various places in Gilgit and other sources. I can't recall exactly where these ones are from. Do you remember? I think these are from Central Asian findings.
I think this might be
Turfan finding, yeah. So from Central Asia. So Buddhism was through that whole Silk Road from modern day Pakistan, Afghanistan, through the desert, through to China. And so these were found along that route there. Okay. So the first term, avijja in Pali, and avidya in Sanskrit. So as you can see, this is the first factor of dependent origination, and just a slight spelling variation there. Shall I tell you a fun fact? Do you want a fun fact? Venerable Kalika is shaking his head. He's had enough fun facts for me. Fun fact, in English, right, we spell the word witch as in someone who flies on a broomstick through the air. Yeah, it's spelled W-I-T-C-H. Why is there a T there? Because of this D. It's the same word. Yeah, so that word witch in English is descended from the same Indo-European root, vid, as vidya in Sanskrit or vidya in Pali. That's why we have witch. Video is from the same root. Wicca, as in W-I-C-C-A, the witch's religion, also from the same root.
Wit,
exactly, wit, yes. That thing that one of us has. Moving on. I'm sorry. I don't know why I say these things. It's bad. Okay, so avijja, lack of wisdom or insight or knowledge. All right, moving on. Sankhara. And so again here, the second factor in dependent origination, sankhara in Sanskrit is sanskara. Again, there's slightly different spelling, but you can see exactly the same word. Sankhara vijnanang in Sanskrit, vijnanang. And nama rupang in that case is identical, nama rupang. Name and form, salayatanang, the six senses, in Sanskrit, shadayatanang. Hopefully my Sanskrit pronunciation is all right. Paso and sparsha. Here the spelling looks a bit different, but actually is just, again, it's just the same word with slightly different phonetics. Vedana, vedana. Tanha, trishna in Sanskrit. And again, this is just, it looks a bit different, but actually it's just a purely phonetic variation. Trishna in Sanskrit. I remember when I was in, when we were doing our pilgrimage through India one time, we ended up at a staying at a hotel in Delhi, and they put us up in this very plush hotel, and the bar was called Trishna, which is very apt. Anywho.
It's thirst, right?
It means thirst. Literal meaning is thirst. So actually in Pali, the word Trishna has split in two, and you have the word Tanha meaning craving, and Tasina, meaning thirst, sometimes meaning craving as well, but that meaning of thirst has sort of split open. So that's actually etymologically the same root as the English word thirst as well. Upadana, upadana, exactly the same. Bhava, same. Jatir, same. And jara maranang. And also the same. So you can see that basically the forms are very, very slightly different in Sanskrit, but all the terms and everything is exactly the same with exactly the same meaning. And it's important to notice this because when we speak about the different languages of ancient India and of Buddhist texts in ancient India, you can get the impression that they are different languages, like Vietnamese and English and Sinhalese are different languages, right? But that's not the case at all. They're basically just slight variations of the same kind of thing. I mean, they have their own quirks and their own idioms of syntax and so on, but basically the spelling is pretty much the same. Okay, and here we have another version, this one taken from Pali compared to the Chinese text from the Dharmaguptaka Dirgha Agama. So this is the Dharmaguptaka equivalent of the Pali Digha Nikaya, and this was taken to China and translated from probably Andhari to Chinese. And this is a translation of the Chinese text, avijja, ignorance, dispositional forces for sankhara, consciousness for vinyana, mental and physical process for nama rupang, salayatanang, sixfold sense operation. And again, you can see that for each of these, all of them are preserved in the Chinese. Thirst, like craving, grasping, the will to becoming, birth, and old age and death. So again, through, you know, when we have a translated text, as a translator myself and as Venerable also a translator, then we know that translation is inevitably a somewhat fuzzy medium, that you can never translate it and get it exactly right, but you can still get it close enough to be able to recognize that it's the same teaching there. Here's another version, this time from the Sarvastivadin Madhyama Agama, also in Chinese translation. Ignorance, formations, consciousness, name and form, six sense spheres, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, old age and death. Again, exactly identical. So there we've had three different texts, two in Chinese and one in Sanskrit, all with exactly the same sequence of dependent origination. So again, this is what we say when we say that these doctrines and these teachings are found preserved throughout all of these different schools and these different traditions. We don't mean that there's a vague similarity or a philosophical affinity between them. We mean that they are literally exactly the same words and phrases found throughout all of these scriptures. Okay? Any questions about that? Enkong? Yeah.
Mm.
We can, yeah, we should have put the Chinese there.
Yeah. True.
It's an English translation of the Chinese, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is what we currently use when we describe dependent origination in the English language.
That's correct, yes. That's correct, yeah. And of course, the different Chinese translators would use different words, just as the different English translators do. But, you know, you can recognize that it's the same underlying text, yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, would it be? Next time we'll put the Chinese in there.
Yeah, okay.
I thought I was saying that yesterday, but then I couldn't be bothered, so we didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
But good point. All right. Any other questions? No. All right. Do you want to leave with this one?
Yeah. Oops, what happened? Yeah.
You're getting all fancy with the PowerPoint.
No, it's really simple stuff, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I just add one thing to what Bhante Siddhartha was saying, just to kind of make it more clear, the kind of the significance of the different schools and different versions you saw there. So we saw one version in Sanskrit, two, as Enkong said, it's actually in English, but originally it is in Chinese, a translation from the Chinese, and all of them compared to the Pali. And the significance of this is that these schools have been separated for a long, long period of time. Yeah? The Sarvastivadin and Dharmaguptaka schools probably separated from what is now the Pali recension around the time of Ashoka or soon afterwards. Yeah, so we're talking about almost 2,300 years. So we're getting very, very close to the time of the Buddha. And then you compare them after 2,300 years of separation, and you can see that they're almost identical after 2,300 years. In fact, they are identical because you can recognize the Sanskrit or the Pali words that lie behind the Chinese, and that's why they're translated in this way, from basically studying them. And that is kind of astonishing, isn't it? It's kind of really astonishing. And what that means is that we... if they have been kept so well over 2,300 years because the Sangha was very conservative, because the Sangha felt that the suttas were so valuable, yeah, we really had to look after them properly. There's only 150 years before that, the time of the Buddha. We can assume that the Sangha was conservative also for those remaining 150 years. Like what we have today is basically the word of the Buddha. That's kind of what comes out of that.
A lot of people here might not be familiar with the context, but there are quite a lot of very skeptical scholars today, especially within American academia, and they sort of it's almost kind of shocking the extent to which. Like you don't study actually the Buddha in universities in a place like America. I went to a conference called the American Religious Studies a number of years ago, and you know, there was like maybe 60 or 70 papers presented from Buddhist academics, and mine was the only one on early Buddhism. I think there was one more that presented something on the Vinaya. So nothing on the Buddha, the Buddha's teachings, the early Buddhism, the schools of Buddhism, King Ashoka, or anything that happened within the first 500 years of Buddhism. And that's normal. That wasn't an exception. Everything, I've checked the details of those conferences every year since then, and this has become normal. So this idea has been that anything taught in the early period of Buddhism has simply been wiped off the curriculum, because certain skeptical scholars argue that we don't know what these teachings were. And the basis of this skeptical argument is simply that, yes, well, maybe they did preserve these things in identical form for the 2,300 years, but we don't know whether they did it for the 200 years before that. So therefore, we won't even bother paying any attention to it, and we won't teach it to our students, and it's off the curriculum. And again, you may think I'm kind of exaggerating, but I'm really not. And it's like so unfortunate that these kind of very ideologically driven approaches to teaching Buddhism have derailed a kind of more rational and sensible approach to understanding Dhamma throughout much of the academic world, especially in America. Not all academics, obviously, and there are some great academics and teachers of Buddhism in America, that's no doubt about that, as there are in other places in the world. But unfortunately, they're a bit of a minority these days. So anyway.
Yeah. Shall we have little breaks? Is that a good idea? Like 5 minutes meditation here and there?
Okay. Oh yeah, actually that's a good idea. Hang on.
2 hours is a long period.
2 hours is a long period.
Going. Yeah.
Now, what are we now? We're now 3, 4, 5.
Just over an hour already.
Shall we have maybe we'll have like a 10 minute meditation break?
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you like to have a 10 minute meditation break? Yes, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
It's a good thing that I had that idea. Okay, so we'll have some silent meditation for 10 minutes. Do you want to just keep the eye on the time, or do you want me to?
Oh, yeah, well, whatever, yeah. One of us.
Hold on. Who's going to do this one? Do you want to do this one? You do this.
Okay. So this next part here is going to be about the different versions that we find of dependent origination in the suttas. This is, in a sense, quite interesting because this sort of gets us, moves us to what is the root, what is the basic idea of dependent origination. When you start reading the suttas, you realize that there are versions of it, as we saw before, which has 12 factors. You find versions that have all kinds of number of factors. I don't know if there's anyone with more than 12, but there's certainly ones with less than 12, as we shall see in a second. There are versions which change the... Yeah, but that's, okay. But that is kind of merging of two sequences, maybe. Then there is a change in sequence, very often, very common. You have factors kind of put in a different in order. That's very common. And sometimes you find sequences that use the basic idea of conditionality, the idea that one thing leads to another, but the sequence is actually very different from what we find in dependent origination. The factors are very different, but the basic idea, the idea of sequentiality, of causality, of conditionality is the same. So the question arises, when is something dependent origination? When is it not? And this is a very important question to answer, because when you understand what it actually is, then you will be able to know how to interpret the suttas in the right way. When to see something as this principle of dependent arising, and when something actually is something else. So what are some of these various versions? So first of all, I want to look at some of these very briefly at some of these versions that you find, just to give you an idea of what they look like. And the first one here. You see the numbers that we're using here. These numbers are reference numbers for the suttas. SN is the Sanyutta Nikaya. These are connected discourses of the Buddha. The 12 is the chapter number. It's called the Nidana Sanyutta, which is the chapter on causality. And 1 there is the very first sutta of that chapter. So this is the standard version of dependent origination that we saw before. All the 12 factors starting with ignorance, ending with old age and death and suffering, maybe add suffering down there as well. So this is the standard one. But then you have other versions. You have this is 12 factors, then you have 11 factors. Take away ignorance. You don't need ignorance. Why? Because ignorance is kind of implied by choices. So you just start with choices instead. Then you have the 10-factor version. This is from taken from what is called the Mahapadana Sutta. This is the from the Digha Nikaya, the long discourse of the Buddha, number 14. No, Padana, this one. 14. And this starts in, take away the first two factors. You just have consciousness. Is it still dependent origination or is it not? At what point? You can start to see the problem here. At what point do we no longer have dependent origination? This kind of becomes quite interesting here. At least for me, it is interesting. I don't know. So, and then you have the 9th factor. You take away the 6 sense bases. This is the Mahanidana Sutta, by the way. 9 factors, take away the 6 sense bases, the 6 sense spheres. Then we have the 8-factor version, which looks like this. So is it still dependent origination or is it not? So this is what we're going to try to find out here. At what point is it no longer dependent origination? Then we have go from the 8-factor version to the 6-factor version, which looks like this. And you can see here there's even a few changes. Instead of having the 6 sense spheres, here you have the sensed, the senses and the sensed, which is one of the standard ways that dependent origination is also expressed in the suttas. So 6 factors, going down even more, 5 factors, feeling, craving, grasping, continued existence and rebirth. There's nothing about suffering. That's a bit suspect, isn't it? Shouldn't suffering be part of this sequence? Ooh. I wonder whether this is the real deal. It's getting conspicuously dangerous. This is kind of... Then go from 5 to 4 factors. Just consciousness, choices, consciousness, rebirth, and suffering. And so the question arises, at what point do we no longer have dependent origination? At what point do we kind of move into something completely different kind of teaching here?
Sorry, then,
how can we just sort of pop back to 1543?
This one, yeah. Okay, so maybe I got it. Maybe I should add one factor then. Yeah, okay.
Dukkha samudaya.
Yeah.
Free conduct of feeling, feeling craving.
Yeah.
Craving, this is the origin of suffering.
Yeah, okay, so suffering is there, but not in the ordinary sequence, just kind of started out as a. Or is it in the.
I think that's okay. That's kind of mixed up.
Feeling
is a condition of craving, and then craving is the origin of suffering. So you still have grasping.
Go further down. There's more to it. It depends on where in the sequence I was looking at it, you see. Yeah.
Feeling is a condition of craving. Craving, grasping.
Here you have the cessation sequence. Yeah, okay.
But it still finishes with suffering.
Yeah, okay, whatever. The basic idea is
that... You're telling us we've got to get it right, otherwise we're going to be doomed forever.
The basic idea is the same, yeah? So let's stick to the basic idea here. Let's not get too carried away, because otherwise we're going to be in serious trouble. The basic idea is that there are many versions of it, and there have a large number of different factors, yeah? So maybe that one should have had suffering as well, because otherwise we might have a problem, actually. So that's a good point, yeah? So this is the fourth factor version. And there is also a three-factor version, which we're going to have a look at in a second, because that is the most kind of basic one of all the factors. But obviously, if you take, let's say, only one factor, if you just take consciousness, you don't have dependent origination, right? It's kind of obvious. Or if you just have contact and feeling, again, it's not really sufficient to call it dependent origination. So at some point there is a kind of flip over. You don't have it anymore. So this is kind of what this is kind of aiming at, to look at. I also mentioned that there are some other sequences that use the same idea of conditioning between the factors, but actually look quite different from dependent origination. So are these then dependent origination, or are they not? And one of the most very famous one, often quoted ones of these suttas is the following one. This is called the Madhupindaka Sutta. Madhupindaka means like honey, lump of honey, or honey ball, something like that. And very often quoted by people who discuss dependent origination, I suppose. And this is what it looks like. Yeah, you have the senses and the sense. In other words, the faculty of sense, and then the what that sensing, what actually is sensed. From that you get consciousness. Yeah, from consciousness you get contact. It looks a little bit like dependent origination, right? You have to admit. Feeling, yeah, or still sounds like dependent origination. But then, perceiving. From perceiving, thinking. From thinking, mental proliferation. From mental proliferation, perception and notions born of mental proliferation. Actually, you have a different translation.
I haven't
used yours. Is that bad?
I don't know. That's a really hard one to get right, the translation.
Pancha Sanya Sanka.
Yeah. The basic idea is that it overlaps with dependent origination.
It also goes in a very different direction at a certain point. So the question then is it dependent origination or is it not? Yeah, you can see why this can get quite confusing. It looks very close, but is it really dependent origination? And there's another sutta which is very similar to that, and this is called this is from the Digha Nikaya, the long discourse of the Buddha. This is the 21st discourse, known as the Sakka Panya Sutta, the questions of Sakka. Sakka is one of the great gods of the Buddhist cosmology. Yeah, so the Sakka, the god, comes down and asks the Buddha questions. Does that make sense? Do you think that happened? Is that likely to have happened? Yeah, maybe it did happen. Yeah, we're kind of looking at the world from very different eyes than we normally do in our ordinary life. So it's kind of interesting. Sometimes you have to kind of distinguish between what is Buddhist mythology and what actually really happened. And sometimes it can be hard to pull these things apart. But this is anyway the story behind this, is that Sakka, the lord of the devas of the heaven of the 33, came to the Buddha and he asked these questions. And what he asked then gives rise to a certain sequence. And this sequence too has the same kind of conditionality between the factors as you find in the dependent origination. So it looks a bit like dependent origination. But as you will see, the actual factors are quite different. Yeah. So it starts off with the perceptions and notions born of mental proliferation. Don't worry too much about the meaning of this, because it's a bit tricky. But we might discuss that later on. From that, you then have thinking. Desire. From thinking, you have desire. Yeah. the idea here is that you think about things and then you kind of you discriminate, yeah, and then you desire according to the discrimination that you have, and you discriminate into agreeable and disagreeable, and then you have you kind of grasp onto the things you like, yeah, envy and stinginess. This is mine. Don't look at my water. Will you look at my water? I thought that you. It's envy and stinginess. I think I get a bit of sutta envy when I see your suttas over there. Anyway, and then because you hold on to things, yeah, as me and mine, you have this what is called mamankara in the suttas, which means my making, you know, mind making. You then guard your things, yeah, and when you guard your things, then of course you have all kind of rivalry and punishment and harming and holding on to yours and punishing those who try to take yours and all this kind of stuff arising from that. Is this dependent origination? Okay, so how do we solve this? Yeah? And this is kind of what I find so interesting about this. We need to find something that we can actually, kind of the ground of dependent origination, if you like. And to find that ground is actually not that hard, but you have to know the suttas really well to be able to discover this. And where this is found as follows. Yeah, this is the root of dependent origination. And the place where it is found, it is found...
Hang on. Let's just pause for a moment here.
Pause, okay.
I just really want to pause and just hang on.
Ding, 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 ding.
Because we've got a moment of tension here, okay, a moment of suspense. Kumali has spent 20 plus years searching for this, okay? And now here we have the unveiling, the secret, right? What is the secret source behind dependent origination?
Yeah.
Here we have the unveiling. I just wanted to click on.
Does anyone know the answer to this, sir? Does anyone
I didn't know the answer until you showed me.
Yeah. What do you guess the answer is to this, sir?
It's something so incredibly obscure.
It's not that obscure at all. This is the interesting thing, right? There's one sutta that makes this connection explicit, but it's obviously So this is this is what it's about, yeah. It's really about the Four Noble Truths. That's where you find the answer to this. Yeah? So back to the very origin of the suttas. Your translation, mendicants.
Thank you.
Yeah?
Thank
if it says mendicants, everyone knows Adan Sudato's translation. Yeah. And what mendicants is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Yeah. So this is the second noble truth that we're talking about now. And so you know what the answer to that is?
Second noble, what's the origin of suffering?
Attachment, craving, yeah.
Aversion?
Yeah.
Thank you. Instagram?
Yeah.
It's an easy target.
So this is what this sutta is, what makes the sutta interesting is it gives you an alternative idea of the origin of suffering. Yeah, this is what kind of makes this fascinating. And this is the answer. Ignorance is the condition for choices. Choice is the condition for consciousness, etc., etc., all the way up to old age, death, and suffering. Yeah? Yeah? So the answer is that the second noble truth is the arising sequence of dependent origination, starting with ignorance, going all the way up to suffering. Yeah? Yeah? And this is the clue for us to understand what is the essence of dependent origination. So this is an alternative way. So, of course, the usual way of understanding the second noble truth is as follows. Yeah? Now, this mendicance is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. This is the standard way. It is the craving which leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is craving for the sensory world, craving for existence, and craving for extermination. I'm just correcting Adan Sudato's a little bit there while I go along.
That's
fine. Isn't it?
No.
Okay, are you sure? Oh, maybe it is. Yeah, it must be. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
It was because one of those ones that you revise all the time.
So the idea here is that the second noble truth and the dependent origination are expressions of the same thing. Yeah. Both the arising of suffering. So if you want to understand dependent origination in terms of the arising of suffering, it can be reduced to the second noble truth. So in other words, if dependent origination, if something in the suttas has the all the parts of the second noble truth, then it can be called dependent origination here. Am I making sense to anyone? Yeah? Yeah? Okay, great.
I think that was a really innovative and really interesting analysis even in that kind of portion, and I was kind of blown over when you did that the other day, because it was something, you know, I've been, as you know, we've both been looking at this for so many years, and I've never really thought that through in the way that you showed it there, where you can just take full factor of dependent origination, and you can show actual presentations from the suttas, where it will take out one factor at a time, and you keep going, and you end up with the second noble truth.
Mm,
and it's just right there.
Mm.
It's been right, and then you can, of course, do it the opposite way as well, which is by taking the second noble truth, you can then expand the explanations of those and give a bit more detail in them, and you end up with dependent origination.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the same thing in a short form or a long form.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was
really brilliant. Yeah, no, exactly. It's quite nice, actually. So, of course.
You were quite pleased with yourself when you came up with that, weren't you?
I was. Because suddenly it just occurs to you, like, bing. Yeah, you know what these things are like. It becomes obvious, yeah. So, what we need to decide then is what are the essential factors here in the second noble truth. Yeah, how do we summarize this in a way which kind of makes sense? And so to be able to see that, let's analyze the second noble truth a little bit. Yeah, so let's put up the various factors. Yeah, so this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. So suffering is one of the factors found as part of the second noble truth. Yeah, it is this craving. Yeah, so craving obviously is the fundamental part here of the origin of suffering. It's craving leading to suffering. Both of these need to be part of it, yeah? Which leads to renewed existence. So rebirth is a fundamental part of this particular craving. It's a specific kind of craving. It is the craving which leads to rebirth, not any other craving here. Yeah? So now we've got three factors. You've got suffering, you have craving, rebirth, and suffering, yeah? Three factors already here. And then let's look for completion at the other part of the second noble truth as well, accompanied by delight and lust. Well, that doesn't really add very much. That's just kind of another way of saying craving, yeah? It's just craving seen from different angles. Seeking delight here and there, this just means that when you have craving will kind of go out into the world wherever it can, yeah, and seek delights in various places. That's kind of the nature of craving. And I thought Bandhasujato, one of the translations you had there was seeking delight in different realms, I think, yeah. Which is a nice one, because it shows you that not only do you seek delight here and there in this world, but this also extends into various realms. In other words, new rebirths and new kind of new existences in the future. So this kind of reinforces some of the other things that we have there. Yeah.
Just scroll back up a little bit onto the good. The Pali here is Yayang Tanha Pono Bhavika, and I think it's worth lingering on this point just a little bit. We will come back to Bhava later, but in this case, you actually have, like, in the full dependent origination, you have the more abbreviated form. It just says Bhava.
Yeah.
Whereas here it has a more extended phrase, Pono Bhavika.
Mm.
And elsewhere in the suttas you have like Ayating Pono Bhava, is future rebirth in the future.
Yeah.
It's even more explicit itself. Again. And once you understand this kind of this idea that the dependent origination is an expanded form of the little one, you realize that these words actually all mean the same thing. Right? These are just different ways of expressing the same kind of idea. And Pono Bhavika can only mean something which is connected to some rebirth in the future. And this is one of those words which is difficult to convey in English, because the vocabulary that we use for English terms is not strongly associated with concepts to do with rebirth. So if we want to, in Pali context, there are a lot of words which kind of have an association of being to do with rebirth, even when they don't actually say rebirth itself. So I'm thinking of like bhava, which means, so a word like bhava, which means existence, like literal meaning is existence. And when we say existence, we don't really think of rebirth if we translate it into English. Another concept might be, say, vijnana, which again just means consciousness, but also is associated with rebirth in Pali.
Another one would be, say, sankhara, again, which sankhara is associated with the idea of a wish or a desire to be reborn in one realm or another. But when we say, you know, a wish or a choice in English, it doesn't really carry that connotation. So there's actually multiple ways in which the Pali has connotations, and it's talking about that to somebody who's familiar with those native idioms, it's obvious that they're talking about rebirth. But when we translate it into English, sometimes that's lost. And I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of modern interpreters try to take rebirth out of it, because they don't really get the fact that that a word like Ponabhava obviously must be talking about rebirth because of the way it's been translated. So one of the things that I did in my translation was to try to, in a sense, kind of lean the other way, so to make it more explicit than less explicit when I felt that those contexts could sometimes be lost. So in this particular case, I translate it simply as future rebirth. It's the craving that leads to future rebirth. So you make it sort of more explicit so that connotation can't be lost.
In some ways, it's even more. It's kind of even worse than that, or even more kind of in need of explanation. That is a word like jati itself. The word jati, which is found in the dependent origination sequence, literally meaning is birth. Yeah, that's what it doesn't actually have any connotation of rebirth, the word itself. But in Indian society 2,500 years ago, the idea of birth always implies rebirth. Yeah, that was the understanding of that society. So if you translate it literally, rather than translate the meaning, if you translate it literally as birth, you lose the connotation that the audience would have had with that word. They would have heard rebirth, even though the word actually is birth. So then you have to decide, are you going to translate literally what it says, or are you going to translate in a way so that you understand the same thing as the audience would have understood at that time? And of course, the whole purpose of the suttas is to transmit meaning. Yeah, it's not to transmit kind of literal words or literal things literally. And for that reason, I think it is quite right, as you have done in your suttas, to render jati as rebirth rather than rendering it as birth. And these little things actually make a massive difference for how you read the suttas and how you understand them. They really change your worldview entirely, and they bring in things that otherwise you would never have brought in. So we're just analyzing the second noble truth. Yeah, so we have suffering, we have craving, we have rebirth or renewed existence. Yeah, these are the three factors. And these ones coming down here, they are just repetition and saying the same thing again. And then you have the craving.
Repetition and saying the same thing again?
Repetition, saying something. Well, that's kind of making the point. And then you have the craving here. It's just defined in a little bit more detail so that you have again, it's more of a definition of craving here. So this gives you an idea of what is the essence of the Second Noble Truth. Yeah, the three things that are the essence of the Second Noble Truth. Those three things are craving, rebirth, and suffering. That is the essence. And because that is the essence of the Second Noble Truth, that is also the essence of the dependent origination, because the two are basically the same. Yes, now that gives you an interpretative framework for deciding when something is a dependent origination. So if we think back now to the things that we saw before, you have noticed that some of the very last sequences, let's just go back because we can actually remember what was there. Yeah, like this one here, for example, it doesn't really have suffering. Yeah, desire is kind of craving, so desire is there, but it's lacking rebirth, and is also sort of lacking suffering. You can say suffering is implied by the hate, etc., but it's not really explicitly mentioned. So I would argue that this particular sequence then cannot really be considered as dependent origination, at least not the complete form of dependent origination. Remember that things can be a sub-aspect. Yeah? I mean, even the word consciousness is a sub-aspect of dependent origination, but it doesn't make it dependent origination in its own right. Yeah? I mean, you can't just have consciousness and say it's dependent origination. In the same way, this can be a sub-aspect of it, but it's not dependent origination in its full form.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah.
What all these sequences of doing, of course, is that they're applying the same basic idea, the same principle, into different realms or different contexts. Mm. So, you know, this one, for example, is looking more at how does, you know, when you meditate and all of that weird, confusing stuff happens when you meditate, right? You know that. It's not just me, is it? That's everyone, right? And your mind sort of spins off and goes in all these directions and it feels like you're going out of control because you feel like you wanted to meditate and then suddenly your mind is all over the place. That's what this is talking about, right? That's what this is explaining. And, of course, that's a important thing, right? Yeah. It's a real thing. It's an important part of practice and it's an important part of understanding your mind and moving forward in meditation practice. And it's using the same principles as dependent origination, but it's not the same thing. And I think this is an important distinction to make, that we can use a similar approach, similar principles, and we can apply that to anything. But dependent origination itself has a certain content. It's about something. And it's not, and it can't be just reduced to sort of an abstract principle that things depend on each other. Mm. It's about a certain topic.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and you can also say that this kind of sequence it is applying the similar kind of ideas. But you can also say that it is actually embedded in dependent origination. Yeah, and this is actually, you could expand dependent origination into more factors and embed that whole sequence into it, because they are part of the process of delusion, which actually creates rebirth and creates these problems in the first place. So it is kind of part of it in a certain way, but it's not sufficient to be called dependent origination, if you kind of get the gist of the idea here. So. Okay, let's move forward again. Okay, so that is what we have. We have the three factors. This is kind of the starting point then of dependent origination. It starts with craving, rebirth, and suffering. That's what you get out of that second noble truth. Does anyone have anything they want to say about this? Any complaints about so far, or any anti-complaints? Any? Does it make sense? Yeah? You sure? Yeah? Okay.
So
I think sometimes it was abbreviated, like you say, because the other factors are inserted. You see that a lot in the Chinese canon, for example. It says and up to, you know, start with ignorance and up to old age and death or something like that. But I think a lot of the time this is how it was originally spoken by the Buddha, because these variations are found in the different versions of the suttas, different languages, different schools. So this is an original way of exposition, because precisely by having different numbers, you kind of understand it from different angles, and it expands your understanding of dependent origination. So I think it's fairly, this is how it actually was done by the Buddha. Especially some of these sequences are actually very important. Like, for example, the Mahanidana Sutta that we saw before, which starts off with consciousness and name and form. Actually starts with name and form, then consciousness, then name and form. It's a very important exposition to make certain points about some of the factors. And we'll come back to that later on, what those points are. But it's a way of kind of focusing in on certain aspects of dependent origination to make those more explicit. This is, I think, in part what's going on here.
Yeah, I think also... In many cases, the variations are very organic. You know, this is the way it's been presented here, is we've got like a list of factors, and there are factors that are either there or they're not there. But the way that they actually appear within the suttas, within the particular teachings, is often much more... there's a kind of... there's an organic relationship between things which doesn't necessarily come across. I'll just read a passage from a sutta here to explain what I mean. So this is from the Jetana Sutta. This is one of the examples which Venerable Brahmali showed on the slide a little bit before. This is, do you want to go back? Let me go, let's just go back. Where we got the,
this
one, 2018, looking for,
I'm coming close,
38. This one. Okay, so this is this one. So we've presented this, and it looks like it's just ordinary dependent origination with a bunch of things missing. But the actual sutta itself doesn't really read like that. It doesn't read like something where chunks have been lost. It reads like something which is an intentional statement. Of course, the sutta being called intention, one would hope it's intentional. Anyway, mendicants, what you intend or plan and what you have underlying tendencies for becomes a support for the continuation of consciousness. When this support exists, consciousness becomes established. When consciousness is established and grows, there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future. When there is rebirth into a new state of existence in the future, future rebirth, old age and death come to be, as do sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness and distress. That is how this entire mass of suffering originates. And so you can see from that presentation that we're not just talking about a bunch of factors and a few of them have dropped out, but there's a particular way of expressing it and planning it, which has a particular emphasis in this sutta to talk about the role of intention or cetana. And so here the word cetana is used rather than sankharas. In the normal way, sankharas, which translate as choices, and here cetana, which is a synonym for that, is being used instead. Cetana, ceteti no ce pakapeti. So again, here you have what is clearly a consciously different presentation, which abbreviates a lot of the detail of it in order to focus particularly on the role of intention. Yeah.